afternoon. It's Tuesday, the 27th of June, 2017, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Mike Robinson, and joining me today, Patrick Henningsen in the studio from 21st Century Wire. Thanks for joining us.
Great to be with you, Mike.
We'll get straight into Grenfell Towers, Patrick, because, of course, we still don't have any official acknowledgement of the number of people who have been killed in this incident, who has been rescued, who's receiving funding and who isn't. We'll come on to a bit of that in a second. But we still get some clues because over the weekend, Diane Abbott suggested a number. And then David Lammy on Newsnight last night was saying, you know, what people say is that if you put numbers out early, there could be civil unrest. That's what they say. I'm sympathetic to that view. I'm going to walk alongside these people. He said the truth is that the media cycle is now beginning to move on to other things. That's the truth. And so what people say that is that in 2 or 3 weeks' time, if you start revealing the numbers, things have moved on. And he then went on to make the point that in one flat alone, people say there were up to 40 people gathering because they gathered there for Ramadan. And he also discussed whether he thought there was a cover-up. And the numbers, he said, I've never said that there was a cover-up, but I've listened to the survivors and the community, and I hear their concerns. I've listened to them explain how 79 is an impossibly low number, how they want some closure so that they can begin to grieve. And he said, I will listen to these people. I will stand shoulder to shoulder with them. They must be heard and their concerns must be heard. But they're not being heard, Patrick.
I think we can go, we've gone a little further than David Lammy immediately in the aftermath of this incident. Mike, we said it was there is a cover-up. And so I think there's definitely a cover-up. I believe that they're definitely downplaying the number of dead. And so this is politically convenient right now for so many people.
And what do you think of the view that Lammy's expressing here that they have done this in order to prevent civil unrest? Is there something in that, or is this a bit of rhetoric to sort of let some people off the hook?
It could be viewed as a bit of rhetoric, Mike, but there is actually some truth in that statement by David Lammy, because if you consider how unpopular government is in general, and you know they talk about all these governments and the media right now around the world decrying the populist movements around the world, as if this has nothing to do with the lousy job that central governments have done in representing the interests of the people whom they pretend to govern for so long. So there is some truth in David Lammy's statement. The shock value from, like, say, coming right out of the gates and saying what their true number is, let's just throw a number out there, 300 or 280 or something like that, that could trigger off more unrest, let's say, than a number like what they initially came out with, I believe, Mike, was 12.
Yeah.
12 was the initial number. So there's some truth in what Lammy said there, but that doesn't excuse the government from covering it up, because the worst part of what they're doing by kicking the can down the road, Mike, is exactly what the MP from Tottenham is alluding to, is that people cannot grieve. You cannot get closure when you're only giving a portion of the story. So that's why it's important. I think Britain's grown up enough they can take the true death count, right, Mike?
Well, I would have thought so. So kicking the can down the road, does that mean that when the number does finally, I mean, he's obviously suggesting that the news agenda will have moved on, but for the community there, their agenda won't have moved on. Yeah. And so I'm not convinced that kicking this can down the road actually helps defuse the situation at all.
It helps the government, and especially if you consider what's happened over the last week, Mike, a new government being sworn in, opening a parliament, and all the controversy around that. It absolutely benefits the government to downplay this, but it doesn't help the people at all. This issue's not going to go away with the people of West London. This is a very tight-knit community. This is unlike any other community, bar maybe a few others, parts of East London and maybe Brixton and Stockwell and places like that. There is no tighter community than West London.
Okay, so the Express here with what they claim is an exclusive. Grenfell Tower was riddled with asbestos, which blew over neighboring homes.
Yeah, so this is what people had suspected. We talked about this, I think, as well on previous shows or on the Sunday Wire, Mike. So this is confirmed. Every single flat and the airing cupboards. Okay, and now if that's the case with Grenfell Towers, Mike, what about all the other tower blocks in London? What about all the other tower blocks in the country? The focus right now, Mike, is on flammable cladding, flammable plastic cladding that was put on all these tower blocks to make them not look like eyesores and lift the overall property values in the areas where they're located, but also to supposedly to supply insulation, but also in reality, Mike, to keep water from getting into the concrete so the metal rods won't sort of expand and large chunks of concrete won't fall to the ground and kill people. We learned that from the BBC documentary.
Yes.
So there's lots of reasons to put this cladding on, but the asbestos, Mike, this issue is the big elephant in the room. Nobody wants to talk about it. Nobody wants to deal with it.
Okay.
They just let people languish in their asbestos-ridden council flats and hope that no one figures out that some people might be dying of cancer because they're being exposed to asbestos for most of their lifetime.
Okay, so this is a difficult situation because we've got the fire risk, we've now got an asbestos risk, and in the meantime in Camden, as many of the mainstream media have been commenting on, but tension, as 200 residents refuse to leave tower blocks because the local housing association attempting to forcibly remove them, imposing what could be described as draconian dictatorial identity checks on people coming in and out of the building. What is going on here?
People need to pay very close attention to this particular story. This is the first story, Mike, of many, I predict. Okay, so what's going on? They've identified a few tower blocks in Camden as being of fire risk because of the cladding, the flammable cladding on the outside. This is going to happen all over the country, Mike. So what they've done, there's 200 residents that are holding out, do not want to leave. The rest are being forced to sleep in a basketball gymnasium in Swiss Cottage, Swiss Cottage Sports Center. If you're familiar with Finchley Road or North London, you'll know where that is, and it's not the best place to be staying. So some families have said, look, go ahead and remove the cladding, but we're going to stay in our flats. So is there anything wrong with that? Well, the council have hired private security and rent-a-cops and who else, who are basically telling the residents that you have to leave. This is a health and safety risk. They're intimidating residents, according to this report by Ham on High and according to other reports. So this is, Mike, what are we looking at here? This is a type of ultimate eminent domain, whereby the state, using this, and I think you call this a cynical use of the health and safety crisis, which was triggered by the Grenfell Tower fire. I think that's pretty accurate, Mike. I think that's what's going on. Very cynical use of this tragedy in order to have this carte blanche to basically pull people out of their flats in the middle of the night because someone deems it a fire risk. This is an interesting area we're going into here, Mike. And I want to say not a little bit disconcerting.
It is disconcerting, and it's disconcerting because what seems to be going on here, Patrick, is that the police aren't involved in this. This is private security firms.
These aren't police. They're dressed like police.
They're dressed like police, but they're private security firms. And if you remember, when we produced that little documentary on the Kensington and Chelsea TMO, the people that burst into that gentleman's house were dressed like police, but they were the TMO's private security firm. And so what we're doing is being conditioned to accept private security firms that the British man's home is no longer his castle. They can burst into your house and expect you to leave because the council says so. And the population as a whole is being conditioned. And of course, if the middle classes are prepared to accept this going on with working class people in social housing, where does it end?
There is no ending to it. They can pull you out of anywhere. If someone could go in your flat, Mike, according to this dictate, and go and test your curtains, doesn't matter where you live, and if those curtains are somehow not flame retardant enough to whatever European ISO standard there is, then they'll take you out of your flat right there and your kids, grab your clothes, you're going to the nearest gymnasium, netball gymnasium, and that's where you're going to live for the next 8 weeks. They said to the residents here, Mike, that it's going to take 3 to 4 weeks to remove the cladding from these council flats, but many of the residents have rightly said more likely this is going to be 8 weeks. I would say double that in some cases, but probably 10 weeks, 3 months out of your home.
Yeah.
So what if you have a job? What if you have kids at school? You know, oh, they'll let you go back in your flat for 1 hour a day to go get essential goods, but then you have to leave and go back to the gymnasium. This is bizarre.
Bizarre. Now, just before we move on to Sajid Javid, I think you wanted to make a point about which political parties might be a little bit behind the whole Grenfell Tower issue, because Labour, none of the mud seems to be sticking to them at the moment.
No, and to be fair, Mike, you know, we came out with the article in 21st Century Wire that the Tory wicker man, Grenfell Tower.
Yeah.
And so, yes, the Tories do hold the feet, at their feet, lots of blame between Boris Johnson, between many of the members of government who voted down on making accommodation habitable, for instance, all the conservative private landlords and so forth. But this is also a Labour problem. In fact, equal, if not more, ownership to this problem you could lay at the feet of the Labour Party, starting with New Labour, Mike. So we had some a few bullet points there, but the whole TMO revolution was part of the New Labour initiatives. And really came into play in the late 90s during that time.
I think what it shows is that there is no difference between the political parties in this. They're pursuing a separate agenda. It's not a political party or party political agenda at work here. So let's bring Sajid Javid in at this point, because he has announced that the government is providing £1 million to support the charitable response to the Grenfell Tower disaster. And this is on top of the £5 million interim fund that Theresa May has announced. So this £1 million is being, well, let's see what he said to start off with. He said the residents of Grenfell Tower have been through some of the most harrowing experiences imaginable, and the response from local charities and volunteers has been remarkable. I have to say, you know, that is true to a large degree. The response on the ground from good people has been remarkable. But my question here is, where is this £1 million going to go? So let's look at the organisation that is going to be distributing this money, and this is it, Locality. Locality has the task of distributing it, and I do wonder where this is going to go. Now, we published an article in 2013 on Locality. It's called Common Purpose in Your Locality. Get onto the UK Column website and have a read at this. A couple of the points that are made in this article. It says a visit to the Charity Commission website revealed that Locality is a company registered with the Charity Commission as Locality UK. Of its 10 listed trustees, there are three of them are Common Purpose graduates. It goes on to say that the Locality charity has already recruited what it called Kickstarter organizations, which are engaged to support the recruitment of community organizers to act as local hosts. These Kickstarter organizations are right around the country, including Bristol, Birmingham, London, Hull, Norfolk, Cumbria, Manchester, Cornwall. Again, the Kickstarter organizations direct links to Common Purpose. What they're talking about is what they were talking about at that time was 5,000 full-time professional community organizers. The links between Locality and Common Purpose are absolutely clear. And so, Patrick, the question has to be asked, where is the money going to go? It's not going to go to the local people on the ground supporting. It's going to go to the Common Purpose connected NGOs and civil society organizations that have a less than altruistic purpose.
So tell me if this is a correct way of looking at this. So you have what seems to be a charity or some sort of NGO, but what it is, it's a government arm masquerading as some sort of a charity or community-based organizing type body or something, right?
Right. And what are they?
It's made up of government-affiliated people.
Absolutely. And what are they pursuing? They're pursuing the social change, the social engineering agenda, which Grenfell Tars absolutely represents, because this whole gentrification, I hate that word because it's a soft word. It's too soft for what's going on there. But these are the types of organizations that are pushing that policy.
So this organization is taking advantage of a massive human tragedy, Mike, And then so they're putting, someone's offered up, the government's offered up $1 million, right? So most people are going to look at this, Mike, and they're going to say, well, that's a good thing. It's a great, oh, the government's giving £1 million to the community. This is the way it looks from the public optics. And so who's going to argue with that? And, you know, what sort of cynical person would challenge that, Mike? But what is this? Is this a payoff in terms of it's going to pay off third sector, key people? It's going to identify leaders out of this crisis as well and maybe recruit them under the common purpose fold.
Absolutely.
Put them on leadership training courses, which cost £5,000 a weekend or something like
that. That's about that, yes.
And so that's tied aid because that money's already behind the scenes anyway. It's being earmarked. This is all going to be spent on programs, Mike. To train people or to bring up the next generation of common purpose leadership. Is that what's happening?
Absolutely what's happening, yes. So. Yes, and I know some people are going to find this a little bit difficult, but over the weekend, Jo Cox had a memorial plaque unveiled by her children in the House of Commons. I don't think it's a coincidence that the background on the shield there is purple and green, which are the colours of common purpose, because if you look at how the Jo Cox Foundation is spending its money, it's exactly the same type of thing. It's spending its money on these types of civil society organizations, aside from the fact that they're giving thousands or hundreds of thousands of pounds to the White Helmets. But the other projects that they're also funding are exactly these types of civil society. So Jo Cox, her name has been hijacked. And maybe she believed in these kinds of organizations, but the foundation is spending money in areas that perhaps we shouldn't.
Leave that image back up for a second, Mike. What do you call the study of this sort of symbology?
Heraldry.
Yeah. So if there's any of our viewers out there, UK Column viewers can look at this image who might be astute in the study of heraldry.
Yeah.
Tell us what the symbology of this shield is. Certainly there's an interesting design there.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Now, apologies for not having a news program yesterday. We did have a technical issue in the studio. But yesterday was International Day in support of victims of torture. And this is the United Nations. And they're saying torture seeks to annihilate the victim's personality and denies the inherent indignity of the human being. At this point, we've got to mention that Britain has been absolutely and still is involved in torture. We'll come on to that in a second. Despite the absolute prohibition of torture under international law, torture persists in all regions of the world. Concerns about protecting national security and borders are increasingly used to allow torture and other forms of cruel, degrading and inhuman treatment. Its pervasive consequences go beyond the isolated act on an individual and can be transmitted through generations to lead to cycles of violence. Well, this is what the United Nations had to say on this. And in order to celebrate the International Day in Support of Victims of Torture, they held an event at King's College in London yesterday, held jointly with the International Bar Association. It was a high-level panel discussion, and it was aimed, apparently, at reaffirming in these critical times the absolute prohibition of torture. Let's see what.
Look at how they're marketing this, by the way, Mike. So torture is only something that happens in Banana Republic African countries, right?
Right.
Doesn't happen in U.S. black sites or British military detention facilities.
Right. So let's see what the British government had to say. His name is not Johnny Appleseed, by the way. I do apologize. That is a placeholder for other texts. This is Lord Ahmad, and he said the UK government condemns torture in all circumstances, and that he calls on governments around the world to eradicate this abhorrent practice. Well, it was only a couple of days ago that The Telegraph had this headline: US interrogates detainees at Yemen black sites rife with torture. Hundreds of men swept up in the hunt for Al-Qaeda militants have disappeared into a secret network of prisons in southern Yemen, where abuse is routine and torture extreme, including the grill in which the victim is tied to a spit-like a roast and spun in a circle of fire. And this is according to Associated Press. They're saying that there are at least 18 clandestine lockups, as they describe them, around southern Yemen, run by the UAE or by Yemeni forces created and trained by UAE. So in other words, this is US-UK backed.
Saudi backed.
And Saudi backed. Right? And let's just remember, it's only a couple of months ago that the Supreme Court issued its judgment on a case of, well, this is just one of many cases, but they have said here that, that Jack Straw and everybody in the New Labour administration that was linked to this have a case to answer with regard to Libya, where a couple of people were kidnapped in Thailand, taken back to Libya and tortured in Libya, and that British officials were involved because they were questioning this person, the people that were being tortured, and that some of the questions that were being asked were being formulated by MI6. So that was proved in the spice, or at least agreed that took place by the Supreme Court just a couple of months ago. Britain absolutely complicit in torture. Has been for many years. Nothing has changed despite our claims to the contrary.
Maybe the UN should have the International Celebration of Torture Day. Maybe that would be more apt, I think. They could, run clinics and stuff like Armed Forces Day.
Yes.
To teach kids how to do enhanced interrogation and things like that. Because they do put the kids on the guns now on top of the tanks.
You absolutely, yes.
Practicing being gunners and stuff like that. So.
Right. Syria then. A statement from the White House. Here it is. For immediate release, this came out yesterday. The United States has identified potential preparations for another chemical weapons attack by the Assad regime that would likely result in the mass murder of civilians, including innocent children. The activities are similar to the preparations the regime made before its April 4, 2017 chemical weapons attack. As we've previously stated, the United States is in Syria to eliminate the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria. If, however, Mr. Assad conducts another mass murder attack using chemical weapons, he and his military will pay a heavy price. Well, Michael Fallon, the Secretary of State for War, has butted in on this, and he has said the use of chemical weapons against innocent civilians is absolutely abhorrent. It's illegal under any rule of war. And Patrick, the first question I have in my own mind is, please explain to me what the difference is. We know that Assad is not doing this, but even if he were, what is the difference between Assad dropping a chlorine bomb on a couple of hundred people and Britain and the United States leaving a layer of depleted uranium in Iraq or in Afghanistan and killing, maiming millions of people? Surely, who is the bigger war criminal here?
Or dropping a Moab on a village, or dumping white phosphorus like the coalition did last week in northern Syria. What's the difference between that and Assad's supposed chemical weapons? I guess because you suffer more before you die from a chlorine attack than you do if your whole village is incinerated in 1/100th of a second by a Moab. That's the received wisdom anyway in Western neoliberal responsibility to protect R2P circles. So that's what I'm told, Mike, but it's not actually written down what this distinction is.
I'm afraid I have to say that Michael Fallon is a disgrace to humanity at this point.
Well, so the use of chemical weapons against innocent civilians is absolutely abhorrent, and it's illegal under any rule of war. Well, so is arming internationally recognized terrorist groups. So is sending them cash. So is allowing them to come back to your country and giving them absolute economic support, political clout, legitimacy, removing them from the terrorist list after that in the case of Al-Nusra Front and the groups like Ahrar al-Sham. That is actually against British law, European law, international law, U.S. law. And that is the policy that has been the policy of the U.K., France, the United States, Norway, the Netherlands, and many, many, many other countries, including our GCC allies, Saudi Arabia and Qatar and the UAE, for the last 7 years, Mike. So Michael Fallon, would be nice if you address some of those points before you're lecturing the world on the horrors of chemical weapons.
Right. So let's get back to the White House press release. So once again, do they think that that the members of the public are so stupid as to once again believe an intelligence report on the use of weapons of mass destruction in a foreign country. Have we not learned this lesson from 2003 onwards?
It all sounds familiar. Just like the torturing from 2003 onwards or 2002 onwards. That's the same old story again. Just chemical weapons once again. What is it, Mike? What is it?
Well, what it is fake, Patrick.
So this is interesting. This is the inspection by the moderate rebels.
This is for the April?
This is after the Khan Shahoun sarin attack, which supposedly took place in Idlib, which Michael Fallon's referring to there.
Yes.
And the White House press secretary, or the White House press statements, refers to. This supposedly happened. This is what triggered the U.S. airstrike against Syria. And look at this. You've got these three people standing around, pretending to be busy wearing rubber gloves.
Well, actually,
and
sitting in the hole that the bomb is supposed to have made, right?
And those are the $1 surgical masks, which you can buy at the pound stretcher. So these are supposedly the sarin experts deployed by the U.S. and Britain. By the way, the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons wanted to mount an independent investigation into that attack.
Yeah.
Two countries blocked it, Mike, stood in its way at the U.N. Which two countries were they? Take a wild guess. I'll give you two guesses. I'll give you two chances.
UK and US. Thank you.
Winner.
Okay, and of course, I believe at the time you said that this was a load of nonsense.
Well, this is what we said at the time. This is one of the more tame articles which we published at the time, but without any evidence. Trump launches 59 cruise missiles. Only, I think, 23 of those actually landed, by the way. But to destroy the Syrian Air Force Base at Sharat Air Force Base in Homs. So we knew it was a hoax.
Yes.
When it happened, Mike, even though the media ran with this story and so enthusiastically.
Well, we knew it was a hoax at the time, but apparently Seymour Hersh now has come out and said that not only was it a hoax, but U.S. intelligence knew that it was a hoax.
This is an amazing story, Mike. So, by the way, Seymour Hersh could not get this published in the London Review of Books. They spiked the story. So he had to go to the German publication here, Welt. I can't pronounce the full name of the publication, Mike. Maybe you could help me there. But so Hersh is basically saying here, this can't be published in the U.S. None of the New Yorker or any of his former employers won't touch it. London Review of Books won't even touch it, because that's where Seymour Hersh published debunking the 2013 East Ghouta chemical attacks, sarin attacks, that the U.S. and Britain nearly went to war on the back of. Okay, so here he is. Now, apparently, the Trump ordered the generals, or I guess McMaster and Mattis ordered themselves, to go ahead with the airstrike, even though they knew that there was not any evidence to suggest that Bashar al-Assad had launched a chemical attack on his own people, much less a sarin attack. So that is according to Seymour Hersh, award-winning investigative journalist, probably one of the top people in his field, who's alive today. And this has been blackballed by the Western media, this story. So that's according to Hersh. I have no reason to doubt Seymour Hersh, because he's been right about just about everything else in his career. So what did Trump gain from this at the time? You got a bump in the polls, okay? The media absolutely ran with this, and this is regarded as Donald Trump's greatest achievement so far as president, and it's based on a fake. It's a hoax.
But who considers this to be Donald Trump's highest achievement? The Western media?
The Western media does, and even CNN and some of the neoliberal interventionists were lauding Trump at the time, saying, oh, he's finally presidential. Look, he's launched a cruise missile strike against the evil Assad. So this is all based on a lie, basically.
And just to make this point once again, do you think Trump is signing off on these things, or has he absolutely delegated this authority to McMaster and Timmerson and these kinds of people?
According to the conversation we had with Daniel Faraci from Washington, D.C. on the Sunday Wire just 2 days ago, Trump has delegated all of these types of decisions to the Pentagon, basically, or the DOD, the Department of Defense. So there's been a coup. There's a military coup, which Trump was voluntarily really handed over this power to the military. He signaled this during the campaign. He says, I'm going to, my generals will make all these decisions for me. And so that was sort of in lieu of his lack of political experience and so forth. Very dangerous move that Trump did by telegraphing that. But the point of this Hirsch story, Mike, is Trump had the knowledge. He had access to the intelligence that there was no intelligence that said Assad launched chemical weapons against his own people. Trump knew this, and he allowed the attack to happen anyway.
Yeah.
So.
Okay. Well, Michael Fallon has been in the news quite a bit in the last day or so. And in this case, he was talking about the rise of Islamic State outside of Iraq and Syria. And particularly, he was talking about in the Philippines. And so he was given an interview to Sky News, I think, this morning. And he was asked about this. He said that it's a reflection of the success the coalition is having in helping Iraqi forces drive Islamic State out of Iraq. It's inevitable that you would see offshoots of Islamic State springing up in other countries. And he went on to say that this is a worldwide terrorist phenomenon, and we now have to deal with it on a global basis. And the point here is, Patrick, you've made this point to me this morning before the program. The Philippines has had an Islamic insurgency for how many years?
It's the world's longest running Islamic insurgency on the planet, Mike. 400 years in total in the Philippines. So this didn't just pop up in the last couple of years. And they're not ISIS either. Okay, ISIS is a brand like Al-Qaeda. And all you need to do is put the patch on your jacket and print out the flag on your inkjet, put it on the back of the wall, film the video, and you're ISIS, basically. So are there any Arab extremists or ISIS people in the Philippines? Maybe a couple, but overwhelmingly, this is a Filipino Islamic extremist phenomenon that's been going on for how long? 400 years.
Yep.
So I'm asking myself, what does Michael Fallon actually know? This is a good question. And so he's in charge of your defense. He's making this statement, which is completely ill-informed and taking things, blowing things out of context. Yes, if there is an ISIS phenomenon in the world, it's probably mostly due to the activities, intelligence activities, and the funding of the United States, its NATO allies, Saudi Arabia, and other GCC partners. That's what's driving, if there is an ISIS phenomenon, Mike, it's being driven by those factors, not by any sort of grassroots Islamic organization itself. But the one in the Philippines, Mike, it's kind of faux ISIS. It's like, because, you know, if we adopt the ISIS brand, we'll seem a bit more bad, hopefully gain some global support. But are they ISIS? Not really. They're not, definitely not Iraq and Sham. ISIS is, yeah, the Islamic State of Iraq and Sham, or the Islamic State of in the Levant, which is not the Philippines.
So. Yeah, indeed. Right. So Fallon talking about the expansion of ISIS and so on, and how great Britain is doing in supporting the United States getting rid of ISIS in Iraq and Syria. We're doing a fantastic job. Well, the BBC's Middle East correspondent, of course, senior Middle East correspondent, is Jeremy Bowen. And he has a series on BBC Radio 4, which I happened to catch a little bit of yesterday afternoon. And he was talking about the implications of ISIS being defeated in Syria and Iraq. And I just want to play a short clip of this.
Think of the war in Syria as a deadly layer cake. The fight against the Assads is just one layer. Each foreign intervention adds another. The conflict between Kurds and Turks, shootouts between rebel factions, the proxy war between the Saudis and Iran. The most dangerous layers are being added now. One is what follows the campaign to destroy Islamic State's self-styled caliphate. President Obama restricted the US military to the fight against...
Okay, so Patrick, it's a layer cake.
It's an evil layer cake, according to the BBC's senior Middle East correspondent, Jeremy Bowen.
Right. And so he then went on to say that once ISIS is defeated in Iraq and Syria, that it would take a very little event to cause a more general conflict in the region, a much broader, more general conflict in the region. Should we take that as perhaps a little bit of a threat?
It does sound like a veiled threat. So in other words, if if Assad doesn't capitulate, then we're going to start a multi-nation conflagration in the Middle East, or an Arab-on-Arab war. So a little bit of a veiled threat there, it seems to me, from the BBC. So this whole proxy project hasn't gone so well. And oh my God, shock horror, if Assad ever wins, that's just going to be the worst of the worst. But you know, he talks about this layer cake, this delicious layer cake. He describes all the layers in that beautiful Radio 4 style. But he doesn't say who's baking the layer cake,
yeah,
Mike.
Yeah.
And so who's baking this cake? I guess it's a self-baking cake.
Yes.
All these things just happen organically.
Just by accident.
And, oh, it must be the Arabs. You know, they've been doing it for years. The Shiites and the Sunnis. But who's baking the cake? Well, the chef is in Washington, D.C. He's in Langley, Virginia. The chef is in London. The chef also has a franchise in Paris.
Yes.
The chef also has a franchise in Riyadh. And they all get together and bake this wonderful layer cake. But Jeremy Bowen doesn't want to talk about who's baking the cake.
Yeah.
He just wants to describe it. And great.
Well, I mean, you know, you say all that, but we've got to assume that that's not true, that in fact it's Russia that's building the layer cake, because, of course, Russia is behind every event that happens in the West. It's behind elections of presidents, it's behind elections of prime ministers, it's behind all kinds of things. So here we've got The Independent claiming that Donald Trump has said that Barack Obama colluded by not pursuing Russia's election hacking. So Donald Trump now believes that Russia hacked the U.S. election. Is that correct?
Well, this headline is spun here by The Independent to give credence to the idea that Russia somehow hacked the U.S. elections. And as I've said, and you, I don't know about your program, but from the beginning, we said that the whole Russia hacking the U.S. elections talking point narrative is a hoax. It never happened. There's more evidence that the Department of Homeland Security hacked U.S. election systems. Just Google DHS Georgia and hacking U.S. election systems, and you'll see that evidence. But the real thing that this is all designed to do is to cover up the fact the person who was the people, parties who were really involved in skewing the U.S. elections were the White House, was the Democratic Party, was the Democratic National Committee, was the Hillary Clinton campaign, was CNN, was ABC, NBC, New York Times, Washington Post. We're all actively involved in colluding to basically derail the U.S. 2016 elections. Mm-hmm. So they've made a fake story to protect the president, which is that Obama wanted to exact revenge on Putin. So Obama overplayed his hand with Russiagate and maybe took things a little too far. But he felt that he had to do something to punish the Russians for meddling in the U.S. elections. So it was first hacking, then it was downgraded to meddling, then it was downgrading to influencing, and now I think it's been downgraded to, I'm not sure, I think influence is the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So this is a completely fake story.
But Patrick, come on, the mainstream media would not create fake stories.
Well, they wouldn't, but looks like they've done here once again. So CNN, three CNN journalists have resigned over a fake Russian Russiagate story here. So this is amazing. Three have tendered their resignations. I think they've been asked to be fired, you know, whatever you want to call it. So I think there was probably a threat of a defamation or a libel suit behind the scenes. This is certainly what it looks like. They named Anthony Scaramucci in this story here, and he was a close advisor to Donald Trump. Plus, he's a regular contributor on the Fox News Network, very popular. So he was named, supposedly met with a Russian hedge fund or investment portfolio manager and allegedly discussed lifting of Russian sanctions, which anybody can talk about. There's nothing illegal about that.
Yeah.
Everyone's speculating, when are sanctions going to be lifted? Everybody wants to know. So they've been asked to leave CNN. And this is the amazing thing, Mike. They've issued this memo.
Right. Well, just before we get onto the memo, I just wanted to comment on the headline here, because this is USA Today's take on it. And it says CNN journalists resign over Russian story snafu. It was just a snafu. Just a mistake, Patrick.
Yeah, it wasn't fake news.
It wasn't fake news.
It was just a mistake, so, yeah.
That says to me that Russia, that USA Today and mainstream media actually pretty concerned about this story. They're wanting to downplay it as much as possible.
Yeah.
But you've just mentioned a memo.
Yes. This is unbelievable. Here's a tweet that came out from Mark Amos. about this story. So the email went out. And so Rich Barbieri, who's the executive editor of CNN Money, no one should publish any content involving Russia without coming to me or Jason Farkas, who's the CNN's vice president. So basically all the way up to the vice president level at CNN, Mike, if you're doing any Russian stories, has to go through head office at CNN. They're scared. There was some major legal threats here. Mm-hmm. So this is going to change editorial policy at CNN from this day forward. I guarantee it.
And do you think that would affect other mainstream outlets?
It could. But what this is, what else is, this is going to send shockwaves through the media. But this is also going to be used to the benefit of the White House, who've had this sort of adversary relationship with CNN for quite some time now. So this is giving them a lot of leverage, Mike. So CNN is really on their back heels. They're making an absolute feast out of this right now in the right-wing media in the United States right now.
Okay, but sticking with Russia then, because apparently the British Parliament was hit by a cyber attack as what, Russian hackers attempted to get into email accounts belonging to British MPs? Is that what's going on?
Well, they think it's Russia, Mike, and why you might as well say it's Russia. If you can't figure out who actually did it, just say that Russia did it. So 90 email accounts in Parliament, which I assume have the highest level of all possible security on the planet. So who else could do that but Putin and his crack team of hackers in the basement somewhere?
Of the Kremlin?
Or somewhere in St. Petersburg or something. Who knows?
But the Register being a bit more sensible about this, perhaps?
Well, quite rightly, because they're saying this was a brute force hack. So if this was a brute force hack, then it would have to get through basically a two-step identification process, which most governments and corporations have, this two-step ID apps that in order to get through that, you need to, it's not impossible, Mike, but it's difficult, okay? So to hack 90 of these, you would have probably more likely had. So what the Register is saying is either they didn't have two-step identification protocols at Parliament, or it was optional. And worse, some MPs and people in Parliament opted not to use two-step
authentication
because of convenience. Maybe it's faster when you're on your iPhone in the pub at lunch. You don't need to do two-step ID. You can just log on real quick. So they're vulnerable to basic hacking at that point. So not even state-sponsored level hacking for anybody could sort of do the job.
We should all be very proud because the new British aircraft carrier, the Queen Elizabeth, has set sail. Lots of photographs in the media about it just squeezing underneath the fourth bridge by 6 inches because it's such a big ship. This is what's being presented. But unfortunately, there were so many images of this ship pushed out by the Ministry of Defence, that some bright sparks noticed that the computers on board HMS Queen Elizabeth are running Windows XP, which of course is unsupported by Microsoft. If you remember a few weeks ago, the ransomware attack on the National Health Service, that was all Windows XP computers that were. So the question is being asked, are the Russians going to hack the HMS Queen Elizabeth? I would imagine they are because they're hacking just about everything else, as we know.
Why don't we just say the Russians did it before it happened?
Before it happens, yes.
So if it does happen, we're just saying ahead of time, Russia did it.
So the Ministry of Defense, very, very proud that this ship has set sail. Of course, as you can see, there are no aircraft on deck because the F-35s have been grounded again this past week for various other things.
So that's an aircraft carrier. Let's take a look at that. It's an aircraft carrier, right?
Yeah.
So where are the aircraft?
No, we don't get those for another 5 years.
Okay. Gotcha.
Probably at the earliest, right? So Windows XP, they're really concerned. The commander on the carrier, Commander Mark Deller, Commander Air, downplayed any security risk, apparently. He said that the ship is well designed and there has been a very, very stringent procurement train. And this has ensured we are less susceptible to cyber than most. Less susceptible. He would say that compared to the NHS buying computers off the shelf, they're probably better than that, that we should think more in terms of NASA rather than the NHS. I find that a really incredible statement from a military officer on a key piece of military infrastructure, that we're comparing that to a civilian agency in the United States. Right. And he said, when you buy a ship, you don't buy it today. You bought it 20 years ago, and that's why you're getting 20-year-old computer technology, apparently, because you don't, in your procurement process, make sure that at the end of the day, you've got up-to-date technology on board. It's 20-year-old technology. So I'm finding this more staggering by the minute.
If I were Commander Adama from Battlestar Galactica, I would say that that ship is not fit for purpose because it can be hacked.
Right. Okay, we're out of time, Pat. We'll just end with this one. You were pretty staggered by this. The Express here saying 700 new EU laws have been introduced in Britain since the EU referendum and 1,200 more expected before Brexit.
Well, I saw this last Thursday, and we didn't cover it in the latter part of the news cycle on the UK column last week, but this is just unbelievable, Mike. So this is 1,200 expected before Brexit, whenever that is. Could be 2 years, Mike, could be 2.5. Maybe
could be
never.
10.
But so how many laws then, or regulations, 1,000 some odd regulations as well? So we're looking at thousands of regulations, possibly thousands of laws passed after the EU referendum of last June.
And this was the key point, because the British government said, we remain full members of the European Union until the day we leave. We meet all our obligations during that time. And the Great Reform Bill, the Great Repeal Bill, which isn't about repealing anything, it's about bringing EU law into domestic law as domestic law, converting it to domestic law. That will also convert all these new laws and regulations, and they're going flat out to get as many new laws and regulations in as possible before any final agreement on Britain leaving the European Union, which it isn't really going to do anyway.
You know, I'm not surprised to see this story, Mike, because if you remember in the run-up to Brexit, remember how they were framing both the Leave and the Remain campaigns. For the Leave campaign, they made it all about immigration. Immigrants, immigrants, jobs, immigrants, okay? And the same with the Remain. Mm-hmm. Oh, we're going to lose jobs and we're not going to be able to immigrate. This is the real reason, I think, why Middle England voted for Brexit. Was for that reason right there.
Absolutely.
It was because the European superseding the sovereignty of the United Kingdom. And so because the media had downplayed that aspect of Brexit and why people wanted to vote for Brexit, this was just practices of just allowed to continue unfettered, unrestrained since the referendum. Yeah. It really shows more than anything, this story shows what a farce the whole conversation is on Brexit.
Glynis in the chat box saying that she thought that it only applied until we triggered Article 50. I'm afraid that's not the case. We remain full members of the European Union with all our obligations, and we will meet all our obligations until Brexit is signed, sealed and delivered, if it ever is. And in the meantime, as I say, the Great Repeal Bill brings all that legislation from the European Union and puts it on the British statute books, where it becomes considered as UK domestic law. Yeah. Okay, that's it for today. Thank you very much, Patrick, for joining us. Thank you for joining us. We'll be back at the same time, 1 p.m. tomorrow. See you then. Bye-bye.